The court will call him here as Dolores Heffernan in Commonwealth of Virginia.
Good afternoon, judges. My name is Elizabeth Toomey on behalf of the appellant, Dolores O'Brien Heffernan, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Judge, this case is really just about, well, two things, preservation of error and the power and the limitations of summary contempt. The law seems very clear that there are two types of contempt, direct and indirect, but they often get confused. Direct contempt, of course, occurs in the presence of the court, and all of this comes from relatively recent case of Cialdone versus Commonwealth. So direct contempt is in the presence of the court, and because the court has knowledge of all the facts, because the court has seen everything that it needs to decide, there doesn't have to be a trial. The court can just simply punish without further proof. Indirect contempt, of course, is when it does not occur in the presence of the court. And therefore, because the court doesn't know firsthand what happened, the court needs to hear evidence. So there needs to be, of course, a trial with due process protections that go along with that.
But in this case, isn't there the statute that includes in the summary contempt provisions that the General Assembly has set forth coming to and going from the courtroom, that would be part of the direct contempt, even though it's in some sense outside the presence of the court?
Are you referring to subsection 1 of 18.2456?
Yes.
Where they said misbehavior in the presence of the court or so near thereto.
Well, yes, 1 and 2.
The subsection 1 says misbehavior in the presence of the court or so near thereto as to obstruct or interrupt the administration of justice. The statute itself doesn't define it. It just says what is so near thereto as to obstruct or interrupt the administration of justice. The subsection 2 is the one about violence or threats of violence on an officer of the court. And subsection 2 is the one where the trial judge seemed to reference in his concluding remarks. I believe he said something like, because of your threat on an officer of the court, a threat of physical violence on an officer of the court. But the trial judge never, because there was no process here, there was no show cause summons, there was no capias, there was no official process, and neither the sentencing order referenced the particular code section. So one point is that I believe that it's not necessarily clear that we're proceeding under the statute. We very well could be proceeding just under the court's inherent authority because there was never a citation to the statute. But even if the statute does apply, first of all, it seems that it's really under subsection 2 of the statute. Even if we want to look at subsection 1, I submit that it's still not applicable because the trial judge didn't mention that, but that the alleged actions here, obviously did not occur in the court, it was in the hallway, it was on the lunch recess, it didn't interrupt the administration of justice, it certainly didn't obstruct it, because it was on recess. And the attorney who was involved was not a party to the case, he was just simply a spectator. And there was a case that was cited by the appellee, the In Re Saving case, that talked about the act outside of the courtroom. I'm not sure if that's what Your Honor was referring to, but that case.
No, in fact, subparagraph 2 is violence or threats of violence, et cetera, while attending or returning from the court. Isn't that the provision that applies here?
If we're proceeding under the statute, I believe that that would be the applicable section.
Okay.
But I don't believe that that means that you're deprived of due process protections.
But it's all part of the summary contempt. And so in that respect, it's all part of what the court has the power to do for in the category of direct contempt, isn't it?
I don't believe so. I believe that that the statute uses poor language when it references, it says punish summarily.
Right.
That often leads to the conclusion that there can be a summary trial, but the case law seems very clear that there cannot be a summary trial, meaning basically no trial, unless it occurred in the judge's presence and the judge had the full scope of knowledge of the events.
Well, in this case, there actually was something in the nature of an admission from Mrs. Heffernan, wasn't there, when she offered her apologies?
Well, I would submit that it wasn't a full admission. She did say that she apologized. She did have some explanation for it. But I submit that it was not, yes, I said that, and this is what I meant by it, and that's, I think apologies are, and I've written in my brief, one can mean many things when they say I'm sorry. They could just be, she could just be, have been trying to appease the trial judge. She was in the middle of her trial for the other contempt, so maybe she didn't want to offend the judge. There could have been all sorts of reasons for her saying I'm sorry, not necessarily meaning, yes, I said this, and yes, I meant it as a threat.
But I think as I read the statute, and if I'm wrong in my interpretation of the statute, help me out a little bit, is that the summary contempt statute allows the trial judge to essentially maintain the decorum of the courtroom and the courthouse and the court proceeding. That's what that is for. Now, if you were to call me a dirty, rotten scoundrel, obviously I could hold you in summary contempt because it would be wrong, number one. And number two, it would be disrespectful. If you were to go out in the hallway and say to Mr. Murphy, look, if you say one more word about this case in that way, I'm going to punch you in the mouth, all right? And obviously you would never say that. And Mr. Murphy reported that to the court. I think the court would have the ability to cite you for contempt because he's controlling the environment of the courtroom and the courthouse and the court proceeding, as opposed to things which traditionally occur outside of the hearing of the court that the court cannot address because it's not part of the courtroom process. Is my interpretation of the statute wrong or ill-conceived?
I believe that it is. And one of the, I'm going to go back to that In re Savin case where it was something that occurred just outside.
Mm-hmm.
In re Savin said, of course it's contempt. I mean, of course it can be contempt. The question is, what procedures then do? And in the Savin case, they did, there was a trial. They did have procedure. They were noticed to come back to court and they were afforded a trial. So I would submit that in this particular hypothetical that Mr. Murphy would then have to be placed under oath. I would be given the opportunity to obtain counsel of my choice and to present a defense. I believe that's the difference.
But the difference also is that there is a different remedy or prescription that's available under the summary contempt than there is on the other kind of contempt, and that you can actually
Correct.
Get a 6-month jail sentence on the other one. So that I think that's why the legislature in his wisdom accorded more process in that because of the exposure to 6 months of jail time as opposed to 10 days.
That's correct. And that's why in the following statute, 18.247, they had explicitly said this 10 days for the punishment for this direct contempt only applies to subsection 1.
Mm-hmm.
So if the other subsections 2 through 5 were also going to be considered direct or summary contempt, then why would we not apply the punishment prescription to those as well?
Could it be that the judge could, if he or she deemed it appropriate, accord a hearing and let the matter be heard and give the opportunity for presentation of evidence and rebuttal and the like? But if it's the traditional summary contempt, skip all that steps because it has occurred within the province of the court's authority over the proceeding?
I believe that the trial judge could, if he did not observe the acts himself, I do not believe that he could just simply proceed to punishment. I believe that he would have to convene a trial and afford her the right to an attorney and the right to present evidence and all those rights under the case law.
Let's go back to the preservation of the issue. I'm sure Mr. Murphy is going to educate us on that, and so I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is Mr. Murphy incorrect in saying that this matter wasn't properly preserved?
Well, certainly it was not properly preserved.
Okay.
I don't think there's any question about that. What we are asking for an exception under either the statute 8.01384, which was applied to the summary contempt case of Connell versus Amos, or if the court does not feel that that is appropriate.
Well, in Amos, the judge plucked a person out of the middle of the courtroom and held him in contempt for, in his view, lying.
Yes, correct.
Okay, that's a little different. Here we have a party to the action, don't we?
Yes. Your Honor, she was a party, but she was also plucked out of the courtroom and immediately handed off to jail. And the difference between a witness and a party, I don't think is such an important difference because I don't think that either one of them should necessarily expect to be held in contempt any more than the other. It seems to me that the issue is really just that once she's taken away, obviously counsel's not taken away with her. And with respect to the issue of counsel, I submit that the judge had made a ruling. He was unequivocal. He did not give the opportunity for any discussion whatsoever on it. There was no notice that it was coming.
But as you pointed out, you're proceeding under an ends of justice approach here, that the ends of justice exception would allow you to keep this matter before the court. What part of the ends of justice exception would you cite to justify your position?
Well, I do believe that the part about the opportunity, that applies to the statute. For the ends of justice aspect of it, we would rely on the language from Charles versus Commonwealth, which says that application of the exception is appropriate where the judgment was error, and the application of the exception is necessary to avoid a grave injustice or the denial of essential rights. So the denial of essential rights that we submit happened here is the right to a trial with all the due process protections to litigate whether or not she was in contempt.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal, ma'am?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jean Murphy from the Commonwealth. First, with respect to the waiver, under 384, the issue is, of course, did she have opportunity to object? And the Court's already pointed out the difference in Amos is that the defendant was a witness, was unrepresented by counsel, and had absolutely no notice that this contempt might occur. Here, we have a very different situation. The defendant is a party already in a contempt proceeding. So she's at least aware that contempt is a possibility in court. She has a lawyer. She was told the day before about the contemptuous conduct. Don't forget, the Combs attorney reported it. She responded. Then it was the next day that, in fact, she was found in contempt. So it wasn't as if she was immediately told, you're in contempt for this, take her away. Also, the previous day, she acknowledged the threat, apologized. So she's aware of it, she makes it clear that, in fact, she has done it. On the same day that she was eventually found guilty of contempt, she was warned about possible contempt for other misbehavior in the courtroom when she refused to let the judge speak, interrupted him. So she knew that contempt was a possibility, knew that the judge was thinking about contempt. And then, in fact, he finds her in contempt, and there's an opportunity right there to object. I mean, you know, it's not as if this is unexpected. She knows he's been talking about contempt. She had an opportunity at that point to object and say, Judge, you know, this is not right. I should have a hearing. She never asked for anything. Now, the thing is that here we have a judge who provides her with an opportunity to explain. She doesn't say, Judge, I like a hearing. I don't want to talk about this. I want to call some witnesses, or I want to cross-examine the attorney. Instead, she just does nothing, and I think that this is just not a 384 case because she had certainly had the opportunity. You know, the Amos case said that it's going to be a rare case where the individual is precluded from objecting. And I think that we don't have that case here. The court had no reason whatsoever to believe that she had any objection to what was happening as far as the procedure.
If we assume that you're correct in reference to, and it seems like there was almost an acquiescence that there should have been, and we've got a 5A18 on that issue, then ultimately could you move forward with, obviously you argue that she doesn't overcome the showing the burden to meet the ends of justice. Could you move forward in reference to that?
Well, in the ends of justice exception, don't forget, what the defendant has to do is make an affirmative showing of a miscarriage of justice. Now, it'd be a miscarriage of justice, first of all, if there was some question of whether there was a contempt. But here we have a situation where the defendant admits the contempt. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that it was not contempt, that in fact a threat was not made, that it was not a threat of physical violence. So there's absolutely no showing there was no contempt. I don't think we can say that there's a miscarriage of justice when somebody is convicted of contempt who admits that contempt. And I think that's what's absent here is, how can we say that the judge did anything improper, that there's any miscarriage here, when in fact nobody objected, and in fact she conceded, yes, I made that threat. I think that's where the ends of justice exception would be absent.
But there are two aspects to any adjudication of contempt. There's the finding of contempt and the sanction associated with the contempt. Didn't she get both at the same time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so from a process, due process standpoint, wouldn't she, if we were to accept her opponent colleague's argument, at least have been entitled to bring someone in to mitigate or suggest alternative sentencing or something on the contempt finding?
Certainly if she had requested that. We're talking about where there's no objection, she admits, she apologizes, the judge imposes a 2-day sentence, and it seems to me that that is no way a miscarriage of justice. There's nothing that the judge did was wrong. He was faced with an acknowledged threat and proceeded to impose a light sentence.
Okay. If we stop on that line of thinking, and if we go back to the very beginning, so that we look at the issue between summary contempt and contempt whereby you have your full due process rights available to the accused. If we look at the cases, and I'm sure you're familiar with, in In Re Oliver, which is, of course, the Supreme Court of the United States, and then, of course, we've got the Supreme Court of Virginia case, which does follow the same line. And I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this. You know, I'm from Southwest Virginia, so I'm going to butcher it. It's Cecil Dome? Come on, help me. Somebody help me.
Well, my guess would be Sean.
I'll provide the humor for the afternoon. Thank you. But in reference to those cases, they suggest that you've got to have, that it has to have occurred in the presence of the court. So help me differentiate, because that's what the appellant's arguing.
Right.
So can
All right.
help when, me
when,
understand
when
that.
When we get to the merits of the issue, mm-hmm. The question is, of course, first, is it a direct or indirect contempt? And as the counsel for the appellant pointed out, why you have a need for a plenary hearing is when you're in a situation where the judge hasn't seen it, and as a consequence does not have knowledge of the facts. And if he doesn't have knowledge of the facts, then of course he's going to have a hearing to do that. But in a situation like ours, he has that knowledge. He has been told what the contempt is. He has been
Wasn't that hearsay? He didn't hear it.
Right.
It's hearsay.
But the defendant admitted it. So you have a situation where there are uncontested facts before him of a threat outside this courtroom to an officer of the court. Now, Mr. McCandless was not the attorney in this case, but he's the attorney in the overall system here, because the very next day, when she was finally released, he was the attorney because he represented the Department of Social Services. So he's there not as a spectator, but as in fact an interested representative of the Department of Social Services in this ongoing domestic problem. But, so he is clearly an officer of the court. She admits she makes a threat to him. She says, the court says without objection from her, and you acknowledged this threat of physical violence. So that's clearly, seems to me, enough for the judge to have before him knowledge of all the facts so that a hearing is no longer necessary, because he knows what is said to have happened. He knows that the defendant has admitted it. So we're not in a situation where you do need some kind of hearing to decide what should be done about this. And in fact, you know, there was a conceded I think that this is what might bring this back into the direct contempt, that in fact the judge has
so
knowledge.
Well, isn't it true by your explanation, for instance, when I was sitting on the bench in circuit court, I could have hauled somebody in and said, didn't you do da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, obviously it would have been a contemptuous act, and they would be so frightened standing there with bailiffs with guns and in front of a courtroom, they might admit to anything.
Well,
because obviously they're not afforded any due process rights at that moment.
Let me explain one difference in this case, which I think is significant.
Okay.
When the Commonwealth Attorney reported the threat. The court said to Ms. Heffernan, you don't have to respond if you don't want to. And it seems to me at that point, if she had said, I don't want to talk, I don't want to say anything, the court would have had to have a hearing.
So that would have been an instance of indirect contempt. The fact that she made a concession or an admission in the form of an apology converts it into a direct contempt.
I don't think that necessarily, I mean, I think that it brings it within the summary contempt proceedings because, in fact, what you have is no dispute. The judge knows the facts. No one's challenging the facts. He has all the facts he needs before him. So it seems to me that that is why, then you could say under subsection 2, this is appropriate an appropriate case for summary contempt.
Or the lawyer could have said, Judge, I appreciate that my clients conceded the contempt, but could you withhold a specific sanction with regard to the contempt until some other date or something like that?
Right, and that's why I think this case is particularly appropriate for the waiver, because the judge, you know, what did he do wrong here? I mean, he offered an opportunity not to respond. She responded, said, I'm sorry, I did it. And then, you know, he proceeds to find her guilty of the contempt that she admitted. And I think that's why, in this case, the fact that there was no objection is particularly important, because, you know, he might very well have remedied it at that point. And for those reasons, we would request that the decision below be affirmed.
Thank you, sir. Councilman Rebeau.
When counsel was speaking about, you know, Amos had no notice at all that this was happening, one of the issues here was that it did happen on two different days. So the trial judge first inquired about it on day one, and of course there was no charge at that time. And then it was addressed, the judge had admonished her, and then it was over, except that it wasn't over. Because when the trial judge then dismissed the underlying contempt, then he immediately proceeded to find her contempt there. So I would submit that both counsel and the appellant thought that the matter was over, it was addressed, it was finished. Secondly, I just want to reiterate my prior point, is that I submit that she did not admit that she had made a threat, and that was a factual issue that did still need to be tried. If there are no further questions, I would rest on my briefs.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down to Greek counsel.